What we're going to be here starting a new series in a moment in the book of Ecclesiastes. And so hopefully you're ready for that and prepared for that. So if you want to turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 1, it's in the Old Testament. So if you go Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, the Song of Solomon, it would be back there. And just appreciate all the attention given to the book of Hebrews, those of you that hear it and really are willing to listen and be changed and be challenged, along with me, because I'm the same way. Book of Ecclesiastes is going to be no different. I know that God has He has things that He wants us to hear. Been reminded that you can read in some ways you can read the same thing 1,000 times. But then suddenly God says, yeah, no, I want you to see it now. And in the case of the book of Ecclesiastes, it may be the second time you've read it. And God wants to say, hey, let's pause for a moment and really see what's in here. And so let me start with this, so that we believe, so you, this may be the first time you've even heard the name, the book of Ecclesiastes. And that's okay. We believe that the Bible is God's words, and God inspired the authors that wrote the different, we call them books, but they're the different sections of the Bible. And what that means is that through God's Spirit, He moved those authors to write the words that we see translated in English for us. In the Old Testament, they wrote them in Hebrew. In the New Testament, they wrote them mostly in Greek. We tend to spend a lot of time in the New Testament. It's easier for us. It's easier to understand. It's easier to make application for us. It gives you a lot more practical advice. But God's inspiration isn't limited to the New Testament. He didn't move just the New Testament authors, or maybe in most of our world, Paul. He didn't move just Paul to write the words in the Bible. And we believe that equally He moved the men that wrote the texts of the Old Testament as well. So we believe that God inspired every word in the Bible. That doesn't always mean, though, if we were being honest and truthful, it doesn't always mean that we devote ourselves to every word in the Bible, because truthfully, some of them are easier to understand. Some of them are easier to read for us more than others are. And some of them are written to apply to us better in different phases of life. There are some texts that you'll understand better if or when you become a parent, or if you gain experience through life and through age. There are texts that apply better to us when we're young, and so some of the Bible, depending on where it is and where you are in your life, you'll find to be more relevant. You'll find to be more applicable where you are. And likely that means, like I said before, that you tend to find yourself in the New Testament or the Psalms, probably because it's easier to read, it's easier to understand, it addresses maybe better where you are. When you study the Bible, you find yourself in the New Testament books, Paul, or in the Psalms. And today we're going to begin a series working through on Sunday mornings, studying through the Old Testament book of Ecclesiastes, which hopefully you've found by now, either through the index in the front, the concordance, or that's not a concordance, table of contents, or you've found it there after the book of Proverbs. And so this is probably a good choice, because I would be surprised, and maybe I'm wrong, but you probably haven't spent a lot of time studying this book, the book of Ecclesiastes. I haven't spent a lot of time, the same amount of time that I devote to the New Testament or to the Psalms or other books, studying this particular book. And admittedly, if you had read through it in the past, or even if you were to browse through it, it can be a little confusing. This book can be a little bit confusing, and sometimes we can not quite be sure how to take it. If you're a pessimist like me, if you have a negative view on things by nature, you're going to connect with this really well. If you're not, you're going to be looking at this be like, man, this guy, he's got some problems. He's got some struggles going on. It can come across as pretty kind of a depressing book, kind of as a pessimistic book. Sometimes some people read this and they have to get the distinct feeling like, this is really in the Bible? This is a Bible book that God inspired the words of this book? Because it feels like maybe it doesn't belong in the with everything else around it. So you may never have read this book, or maybe you're familiar with just a few of the verses in chapter 3 that point out there's a time for everything, right? There's a time to be born, a time to die, right? That's in this book, and that may be the biggest exposure you've had to the book of Ecclesiastes. So Ecclesiastes does have something to teach us, something to tell us. It's just as inspired by God as the rest of the Bible. And the truth is, it's good. It's good. If you're willing to give it a chance, it's good. And so together, we're going to listen to this unique book. And God willing, every Sunday, we're going to leave through those doors different than when we came in. I hope that is your prayer. It's my prayer for you that God would change us even through this book. So we're going to start with the introduction here, Ecclesiastes chapter 1, and get a little bit of context and the background, and that's important, like who it is and why it's being written. So Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 1. These are the words of the teacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. The words of the teacher, some of your versions may say preacher, the words of the preacher. So throughout this book, this is how the author refers to himself, the teacher or the preacher. He never calls himself by name. He calls himself the teacher. And this Hebrew word teacher in Greek is the same word as the title of the book, Ecclesiastes. The title of the book is just the title this guy gives himself, the one who teaches. The one who speaks in the assembly. And that word, this has to do with kind of an educational setting, or less to do with an educational setting, more to do with someone who kind of gathers crowds. So you've imagined the guy on the street corner, or the guy that has a lot of influence, and people hear, hey, he's having a conversation. I want to go hear what he says. Or he says, hey, guys, come here and listen to me for a second. Listen to this. This is important. I've got something significant to tell you. That's what this word, the teacher, means. And so that's why some versions say the preacher, because it's more of a calling the assembly together, calling the group outside. Hey, gather around. I've got something to tell you. That's the word Ecclesiastes. It's the same word as the title. So this is important to know that, because the way the book starts, this is the words of the teacher. That means that this is someone that the assembly would and should listen to. It's somebody that they would and should learn from. This is the teacher. So this is what he's saying is, I'm the guy that calls and people come to listen to me. So I'm calling and you should come and listen to me. These are the words of the teacher. These are the words of the one who calls that people listen to. He's saying that this person's words matter. They're worth listening to. They're worth gathering for. They're worth assembling for. And his words are calling you to hear, to listen, and to learn. This book, the book of Ecclesiastes, is meant to teach. It's worth turning to. It's worth spending some time in. It's the words of the teacher to the assembly, to those who are willing to hear. So that's the first question we have to ask ourselves. Are we willing to hear? These are the words of the teacher. He's calling to you. He's telling you these are significant. This is important. You can learn from this if you're willing to hear. Who is the teacher? This is just context, so we can kind of get a really good idea about what's about to happen, because it's probably not what you're going to expect. So who is this teacher? He says, this is the words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. So you would probably conclude this is Solomon, King Solomon, right? This is what you would conclude. This is Solomon, if you have familiarity with the Old Testament. Solomon is the king that follows David. He's his son. And I disagree with you. I know I set you up for that. But you're allowed to think that. That's okay. We're allowed to disagree. We can come on different pages there. And I understand why you would conclude that this is Solomon. I understand why people do assume this is Solomon. And I'm okay with that. I'm okay with you thinking that. I just want you to know why I disagree. It doesn't actually make a huge difference, to be honest with you. Traditionally, it's assumed Solomon wrote this book because he says he's the son of David, king in Jerusalem. It says that, right? It basically says this is King Solomon, and many commentators take that approach. My thing is it basically says that. It basically says in verse 1 that it's Solomon, but it doesn't say it's Solomon, right? You don't see his name there. You see a guy who says he's wants you to assume, wants you to draw the conclusion that he's Solomon. He never drops his name through the book. He never says the name Solomon, which leads me to believe, and again, we can disagree. It's okay. It's not going to change much, which leads me to believe that the author, the teacher, wants you to think it's Solomon, but it's not. And he's not willing to say, I'm Solomon, because he's not Solomon. He wants you to think he's King Solomon. And this is common in the ancient Middle East to write a fictional autobiography, to write as though you're someone in order to communicate a message from their perspective. You want everybody thinking like this is coming from this perspective. I want you to assume I'm a king. Assume I'm someone with a lot of influence. Now that we're assuming that, let me talk from that perspective. It's not meant to deceive. In fact, I don't think he thinks he's tricking anyone. That's not his point. But it's there to make a spiritual point. And so as I understand it, the teacher wants us to assume he's Solomon. And there's clues throughout the book that pop up that lead me to that conclusion too. But here's the good news. Whether it is Solomon writing himself as the teacher, or if it's the teacher writing as Solomon, Ecclesiastes is still inspired by God and written from Solomon's perspective. So you can think it's Solomon if you want to think of Solomon. I think it's a guy that wants you to think he's Solomon, but they're both writing from Solomon's perspective. They're both writing as though they are Solomon. One is, one isn't. And that's important. It's important that it's from Solomon's perspective, Solomon's time, from Solomon's context that matters. Solomon was, it says here, the king, right? The king of Jerusalem. He was raised as, and this matters that you know what this guy is thinking and the perspective. He was raised as royalty. He lived a lavish lifestyle. He ascended to the pinnacle of power in his day. He had everything he could possibly want. Every pleasure was there for him. Ecclesiastes is written from this perspective. And it's written to a Jewish audience. And so that's important that all of his audience, you need to know this, all of his audience believed in God. Now, whether or not what they believed from that point on is we don't know, but we know that as Jewish, they believed in God, because of my understanding of the author, what you're going to hear me say is I'll just keep calling him the teacher. And if when I say the teacher, you want to hear Solomon, that's great, that's okay, and you can assume that it's your choice. So again, this is important. The teacher presents himself as the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Solomon writing to Jews who believe in God. And the way this is announced in verse 1 is basically, come and listen. Come and listen and learn from the perspective of the wisest, most successful, most prosperous, most powerful, most wealthy man in the world. Listen to him and learn from him. Imagine this kind of like a seminar advertisement. Right, where he's saying, do you want to hear about life from the perspective of one of the most successful people in the world? Come listen to this guy. It's an advertisement for this seminar, and people would think they would hear this in verse 1, and they think, I can learn at the feet of Solomon? Like, sweet, sign me up. That's verse 1. Verse 2, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Seems like a different seminar. I don't think that's not the seminar. When you said that the wisest, most successful, most powerful, influential guy is going to teach us something, that is not what I expected to be the first words out of his mouth. And he drops like the biggest load of glass half empty at the very beginning. In fact, it's not even, this is just the glass is empty. Right, this isn't even half empty. Like you're looking at it thinking, I wish I had more. This is like, there's nothing in the glass. Meaningless. And he doesn't just say it once. It's like, okay, one time is enough. He says it four times, right? And the first time he says it twice in a row. Meaningless. So that's a Hebrew thing. And some of your versions might say vanity of vanities, right? That might be what you're looking at. So when you put those together like that, vanity of vanities or meaningless, meaningless, sometimes you'll see in the Bible it says the holy of holies, right? Or holy, holy, holy. We talked about that in Isaiah at one point. When they kind of cram words together like that, it's a Hebrew way of saying the most. It's stacking it on top and saying it's the most of something. And like when you're a kid and you argue about how much you love Doritos and you're like, I love Doritos times infinity. And then the next person, they're like, your friend is like, no way, because I love Doritos infinity times infinity, right? And everybody knows like that's more, obviously, because you use the word infinity twice and you were multiplying it. That's vanity of vanities, meaningless, is that the most, more than that, more than what you can imagine. He's saying, verse 2, that as meaningless as possible, everything is totally and completely as meaningless as possible. And you hear that and you're like, man, first of all, that is an attention getter, right? That is not the one that they usually tell you at seminars or conventions where like, you're going to want to hear this. Everything's horrible. And you kind of feel like this guy really needs a hug. Like you just like, come here, man. Like this is a lot, isn't it? Yeah. There's a lot going on. Come here. And just to be clear, the translation, like meaningless or vanity, that word, it's important, that word is going to be used a lot in this book. He comes back to that word. And so, and that word, actually what it means is, it's a word that refers to, if you imagine what, when you come outside on a really cold morning and you see your breath, imagine trying to grab it, right? You see your breath, it's there, but if you try to grab it, it's not there, right? There's nothing to it. You can't hold on to it. You can't make it into anything. It's a vapor. It's not substantial. It's deceitful, right? You thought it was there, but then it's gone. It's empty. And every time you reach for it, you just can't, right? You can't get it. Vanity, they sometimes use the word vanity. The vanity is really, it's the illusion of something that's not there. You're vain when you assume I'm like super, super good looking. And the word vanity actually means you think it, but it's not true. It's not actually there. You're just assuming it's there. And meaningless. You know, there's no substance. It's the most meaningless. And he's serious because he's serious about this whole utterly meaningless thing. Because if you were to say, okay, come here, guy. Let's have a hug. Come here. Tell me what is meaningless. Let's talk it out. And he goes, everything, all of it. Verse 2, everything is meaningless. The whole of it. It's just like that breath you try to grab, and a second later, it's gone. And then he goes on to explain it. Verses 3-8. What do people gain from all their labors at which they toil under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises, and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and then turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. Hold on before I get to verse 8. If anyone wants to ever say the Bible doesn't have science or scientific stuff in there, like this is the hydrologic cycle, right? You see that in there. You see like the motion of the wind. He's actually literally telling you it comes from the cold to the warm and back and right back and forth and back and forth. Like he's saying that here. So science in the Old Testament, before scientists found science, right? Just want to put that there. Verse 8, all things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. So he's like, let me explain to you what I mean by meaningless. Everything is meaningless. And he starts in verse 3 with work. What do people gain from all their labors? at which they toil under the sun. Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. All work is meaningless, he says, under the sun. Pause. That phrase. If you underline, if you take notes, that phrase is the most maybe significant phrase in this entire book, and you're going to see it a lot, under the sun. It's a key to understanding it because it qualifies the perspective of the teacher and kind of explains what he's doing. Because remember, they think they're listening to Solomon, and they think that they're getting the perspective from Solomon, and so there's a little bit disparity between who he was, how he lived, what he accomplished, and what he's saying. And so the key is this phrase, under the sun. All work is meaningless. All work, specifically, under the sun. And you're going to see variations of that phrase throughout the book. And it's there to remind us of his perspective. He's putting himself in a perspective on life. He's specifically writing from a human perspective, an earthly perspective that can't see past the sun. Right? If you imagine in a society that doesn't really have like a full knowledge of the universe and how much is out there, what is in an ancient Middle Eastern culture, what is past the sun? The supernatural, maybe, but that's it, right? Everything they know is here on earth. And so this is a perspective that doesn't see God, that only assumes that what is here under the sun is all there is. This is life without reference to God. That's what he means when he's saying under the sun. Without reference to God, life is meaningless. In fact, Dave even just mentioned this offhand when he was sharing, like, God is what gives substance. And this is the perspective the author is taking. Life without reference to God, a way of living that doesn't see or acknowledge the bigger picture. There's nothing beyond the sun. This is it. Here and now, here on this earth. What I can see, what I can feel, that's it. This is an approach to life where someone either believes there is no God or acts as though there is no God. There is a difference between those two, but both is life without God. One doesn't believe there is a God. One may believe there's a God, but doesn't live like there is a God. And so there is still the absence of God in their life. And that's what this is, the absence of God. And the teacher doesn't actually live without God, right? But he has. That's the difference. He's speaking from experience, though he doesn't live without God at this time. And the teacher will see, and I don't usually encourage people to do this, but you can read the end of the book and you're going to see, oh, this whole time, he doesn't actually think this. Like, this isn't his perspective. If you read the last few verses of this book, you're going to realize this guy this whole time doesn't view the world from under the sun. Yes. And it's actually important to know that at the beginning. He kind of leads you to that. And this one time, it's okay to read the end of the book and find out how it ends. But he does believe in God, and he lives with that perspective now, but he didn't. That's not where he wants us. He wants us viewing it under the sun. Imagine there's no God. Imagine living like there is no God. He wants us to consider life under the sun. Life without believing in or acknowledging God. And so under the sun, let's assume what's here on earth is all there is. Because a lot of us live like this is all there is. Let's assume there's no God and all that entails. That's how a lot of us live. Let me show you. And so in verse 3 again, what do people gain from their labors at which they toil under the sun without God? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. And so if this is all there is under the sun, work, labor, what do you really gain from it? Without God, what do you really gain from your labor? What do you really gain from your work? You're just going to do it again tomorrow. And you're going to do it again tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow until the day you die. You work for nothing eternal. You just work to do it again the next day. You get nothing more than a paycheck. There is no significance in it. What you work for will be gone shortly. Work is just futile because you do it daily and then eventually it becomes someone else's turn. And what did you gain from it? You got a paycheck and you got the chance to do it over and over and over and over again. Generation after generation, he says, they come and they go. Generation after generation, you're just one worker in a long line of people who devoted their lives to work for what, he says, for what? The earth is going to keep going even without you. Ultimately, your work is just busyness while the world goes on and on and on, and then it's going to be someone else's turn to go on and on and on in their work. Your house is going to be someone else's. Your job will eventually go to someone else. You put so much effort into your life, into your work, for something that honestly won't last. And he's saying, why? Why? And you might say, we might answer that question. We might say, well, hold on a second. You're saying it's meaningless. You're saying, for what? But I'm giving myself a better life. I'm giving myself a better life by the amount of work that I'm doing, and I'm giving my kids a better life. In fact, I'm not even thinking about me. I'm trying to set my kids up for a better life, and that's okay, but that's his point. Someone is always going to be working for the better life. Do you know what your parents did for you? They worked for a better life for you, and what are you doing for your kids? You're working for a better life for them. What did their parents do for them? They worked for a better life, and that's the point. Everybody's always going to be working for a better life. And you'll work so hard and you think you set them up, but do you know what they're going to be working so hard for? A better life for them and for their kids. And the person who takes your job is going to be working for a better life for them and for their kids. And the teacher's point is that your labor on earth, what you put your efforts into without the existence God, if God isn't in the picture, if all you do and what you devote yourself to is work, it is the most meaningless thing you could do. Because the earth just keeps going, and eventually you'll be done. I told you this guy's depressing. We'll get to the better stuff. But speaking of the earth continuing on, time just keeps going on and on. Verse 5, the sun rises and the sun sets, hurries back to where it rises. The earth is round, right? This guy's saying that there. We all see that, right? And if you're a flat earther, I'm sorry, but this guy. Verse 6, the wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. Time just goes on. Everything just keeps going on, and you're not stopping it. And honestly, it seems like it's in a rush. Doesn't time seem like it's just in a hurry to keep going and going? And if you aren't observant, day after day after day just kind of rushes by, and the next thing you know, you're like, wait a second, February's almost over? Yeah, February's almost over. The cycles and the seasons just keep going one after another after another. No one is stopping it. You're not stopping it. It's not stopping for you, right? It just keeps going. No one's reinventing this process. Rivers fill the sea over and over. And his point is, but it never changes. Like now people will say yes, but that's the ice melting, right? But the sea never actually overflows. The rivers constantly fill the sea and nothing changes. There's no progress there. There's no progress in life. He's saying, and even here he's demonstrating this, like I said, this deep scientific knowledge of creation, only to conclude, it's just going to keep going and I have no control over it. And even the work creation does is just going to be redone the next day. The next cycle, the next season, it's just going to happen again and again and again. Without the existence of God, if this is all there is under the sun, there's a lot of activity. But each day has no real progress, no real significance, no real purpose, because it's just going to do it again tomorrow. And this is true. Think about your life. While there may be some variation to your days, the truth is they're all basically the same. There may be some little bit variations here or there, but we tend to do the same exact thing every single day with a little bit of variation. And then when night comes, you settle down just to do what tomorrow? All of it again. Right, all of it again, except maybe you're going to get a different flavor of coffee, right? You're going to change the creamer, you're going to be like, I'm going to spice things up, right? That's not, I'm going to get, you know, a large or whatever it is, but that's not what they call it, though. Which one's bigger, grande, vente? Which the vente is the biggest? There you go, Sharon knows. We settle down at night just to do it all the same again. You follow the same routines, and even when you change those routines, even when you change those routines, they're not actually new. you've already changed your routine that way before. You're just doing the same thing again, but this time you're telling you it's new, right? It's not, it's the change in your routine, not something no one's ever tried before, right? You're not coming up with some brand new way of doing life or doing your day, but like, I'm going to do it this way. I'm going to brush my teeth before I take the shower. And no, someone's tried that. Like, people do that. That's not new. And no matter what you do, tomorrow just resets with really no progress. And eventually it will be someone else's turn in your spot, in your job, in your corner of the earth, your little niche in society. It'll be someone else's turn. And without God, this makes each day significantly futile. That's what you're supposed to feel. Without God, it's just going to keep going and going. Without you, yes, it is. Each of your days is slightly varied, but insignificant repeats of the last day. And this reality of life without God, the teacher says, just wears you out. Verse 8, all things are wearisome more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. It just wears you out. It is all wearisome, and it'll get to you. It will result in depression and discouragement. And that weariness, which is the distinct result of life without God, weariness is a distinct result of life without God. The weight of it, the teacher says, you can't even put it into words when you consider the depth of how meaningless it is without God. It's just utter meaningless. And at some point you felt this. You've tried to live life without God. Maybe you didn't consciously notice that you were living life without God, but at some point you've lived this, you've done this, you've felt the weight of living a meaningless life without God. And when we notice that, when we sense like, man, things are just weary, it's just weariness. I'm just like doing the same, I'm retreading over and over and over again. Things don't feel significant. What we do is, instead of acknowledging the real issue that we're trying to do life without God, we try to spice things up. We try to satisfy our eyes and satisfy our ears, the author says, and we try to pursue new, right? And so he says, like, so all things are wearisome more than one can say. And at some point we notice that, but we try to fill the eyes, we try to fill the ears, and the problem is they can't see enough, they can't hear enough, you can't fill enough. But we try to with something new. And the author turns his thoughts there and says, well, that new stuff, like you start to sense the weariness of life. You start to sense the meaninglessness of it when you leave God out of it. And so you try to start doing some new stuff. Let's try some new things, some new ways of making things significant. And he says, well, that stuff, that new stuff, meaningless. It is also meaningless. The most meaningless things, because it's still without God. Your new stuff without God is still meaningless. It's not going to change anything because it's still under the sun. Look at verse 9. Because that new stuff that you're trying to fill your eyes and your ears with, what has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new without God under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new. It was here already, long ago. It was here before our time. No one remembers the former generations, and even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them, so they think this is new, but it's not. So the solution that people find to the wearying realization that everything is meaningless without God is to try to decorate it with new things. Try to add some variety into your repeat of the last day. And so this is what we do. We feel weary, we feel weighed down, and we don't acknowledge or notice, oh man, I'm doing life without God, because God is what brings meaning. God is what brings significance and substance. And instead, we see that and we're like, we're going on vacation. I'm going to go on vacation. That'll end the weariness. That'll bring more significance and more purpose. Or I'm going to go on a diet, because that's the problem. I'm going to feel better about myself. Things feel weary right now, and so we're going to diet, or we're going to move to a new home or a new state. Maybe you're thinking, we just need a big change. We need a big change, a dramatic thing. And so we're going to move. We're going to buy new furniture, or we're going to try maybe a new church or a new club, a new activity. I'm going to find a new job, and that'll bring significance. We're going to maybe you think, I'm going to reinvent myself. We're going to find new ways of expressing ourselves, or find a new identity for myself. Or sometimes even those who are maybe smarter than most of us in this room, no offense, for sure me, they think, I'm going to invent a new phone. That'll bring meaning. That'll bring significance. That'll bring substance. Or I'm going to invent a new car or a new way of communicating or a new way of doing these meaningless jobs. We're going to find new aspects of it. And the teacher says, yeah, so that stuff's not new either. Like, none of that is new. Everything you just said isn't new and isn't going to, it is meaningless without God. Someone already tried communicating, right? Someone already tried the vacation approach, and it just gives you the illusion of newness, but it's not satisfying without God. It's not enough. It's not new. Someone already tried the diet. You tried the diet, right? You've tried 6 different diets, and none of them actually brought you meaning or significance. Someone already tried moving. Someone moved out of your house that you moved into. You moved out of a house, right? And to move into a new one. And someone moved into yours. It's not new. Like, people have been trying new things for a really long time. Someone already tried new furniture. Someone tried a new job. You tried a new job. You got a different job. Someone tried expressing themselves that way. Someone invented all the new things. It's just the illusion of newness. People have been trying to find substance in new forms of communication since Babel. It hasn't worked. People have been trying to find meaning through invention since the wheel, and it hasn't worked. It's not new. All that new, is there, like, can anyone say, look, this is something new? No, it's all been tried. It was already here. That idea, that thought of new communication, long ago, somebody tried new communication. They're like, here's the Rosetta Stone. And it didn't bring meaning. It didn't bring significance. And it'll be done again. Someone is going to invent a new way of doing it. Someone is going to move into your house. Someone is going to get your job or another job. Someone is going to get new decorations or new ways to do vacation. It will be done again. Your new spice of life, your new variety to bring substance and grab that elusive vapor of significance, of meaning, was already tried, and it's going to be tried by others. There is nothing new under the sun, he says in verse 9, and there it is again, under the sun. There's nothing new that brings meaning without God. Without God, life, even new aspects of it, is still meaningless. And then to add insult to injury, the teacher says, eventually, you're going to be forgotten. Verse 11. No one remembers the former generations, and even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. And he's not saying, like, they won't remember they had an ancestor. They won't remember your name. Like, you're going to be in family trees. You're going to be in genealogies. What he's saying is, you're trying all these things like they're new. Your grandparents tried this. Their grandparents tried this. They tried the new things, right? And you forgot that your grandparents tried to find meaning through these things, and now you're doing it. That's his point. People are going to forget all the meaning things that you did, and they're going to try it too. They're going to try those things as well without God. And without God, we're beating our heads against the wall only to wake up again tomorrow and do it again. And so what happens is, here's what happens. We recognize that it still isn't working, right? The new stuff still is not working. And we can feel that something isn't right. The truth is, life without God isn't satisfying. And suddenly the teacher's words about work and progress and our days and our new stuff ring so true and so deep that it makes us uncomfortable, because we're sitting here hearing this and realizing he's right. There is such a significant truth to what he's saying. He is so very right, and it begins to make us a little bit uncomfortable, because now we're realizing everything I'm doing lacks substance and meaning. And what we should do is stop living a life without God. But we don't. What we tend to do is we take that sense of meaningless of what we're doing, and we decide to double down with this idea that right now it's meaningless. But we commit to the idea that somewhere down the road, eventually there is a point in life where things do become satisfying. We feel that way. And what you might be tempted to do right now in hearing, okay, yeah, right now things are meaningless. Everything feels like there's a weariness to it. And I get it. He's right. Like, what am I doing? Like, nothing actually brings significance. I mean, and what we do, what you're tempted to do, is to think that, okay, yes, what he's saying is true. Like, things are meaningless now, but somewhere down the road, there is going to be a point where things become satisfying, and so where we do become content, where we do become whole, just but without God, so we're wrong. But we think that, and we cling to the hope that maybe our days will give us purpose and won't just be sterile repeats at some point. And maybe down the road, at some point, work will finally accomplish something, and something lasting. And we convince ourselves that maybe there's something I can change enough about life that I'm going to find significance in it. I just got to find the right thing. He's right. It's meaningless now. I just have to find the right thing. And that's what we do. And Christians aren't exempt from this. You believe in God, but you don't always live like you believe in God. You still live under the sun at times, or in areas of your life without God. Like, this is all there is, and you cling to it like there's something that you can do, or something that you can accomplish, or something that you can change that will give you satisfaction and meaning, but you leave God out of it. And so you think it's purely work, it's purely daily progress and efforts, and you're leaving God out of the solution. God is what gives us meaning, but you don't do that. What we do is we think, I'm gonna work a little bit harder, a little bit down the road. I'm gonna get to this point, and then I'm gonna do this, and then I'm gonna find significance and meaning. I'm just gonna wait till I get this amount of debt paid off, or I'm gonna wait till I accomplish this, or when I have this size of a family, or when this happens, then we'll find meaning, then we'll find significance. But you're still leaving God out of it. You're still seeming to think that down the road, at some point, if this just happens, then I'll have time to include God in these things or find significance. And what we do is we see the futility of work, or we convince ourselves that maybe retirement will bring an end to the frustration. But retirement without God is still meaningless. And we convince ourselves that next month I'll be more intentional about living in the moment. But living in the moment without God is still meaningless. Or next month, or in a few months, or in the summer, I'll be more intentional about paying off the bills. Paying off your debt, but living without God is still meaningless. You believe that the next house will complete your life and end the weariness, because that's how logic works under the sun without God. At some point, maybe there is going to be meaning. Maybe I'm going to find significance. But without God, it is a never-ending struggle against futility, with the insane belief that we can actually end it. We can actually find significance in the next whatever it is. And now we're sitting at the feet of the teacher in his seminar to listen to the experience and the perspective of Solomon and find out how the most powerful, the most wealthy, the most wise, successful king found satisfaction, how he found purpose, how he found substance, how he ended the cycle of futility in his life. And he says, yeah, no, it doesn't happen. I tried it all. There was another woman. There was another investment. There was another accomplishment. There was another area of knowledge. There was another, and none of it without God brings any significance, brings any meaning. It doesn't happen, not without God. You won't find meaning and purpose and satisfaction like that. You'll want more. You'll try again. You'll wash, you'll rinse, you'll repeat. And it is that devastating realization that the teacher is trying to get us to at the very beginning of his book. He wants us to recognize and see the harsh reality of life without God. He wants to bring you to the point of weariness and raw honesty and introspection. He wants you to admit that you live, even occasionally, Christian, you live in a world of false hope, that on your own, even in some areas, you can find significance and purpose. You can't. He wants you to come face to face with your limitation as a human and be honest about life under the sun, life without belief in God, or that believes in God but doesn't involve God, is an elusive puff of breath, meaningless. It's insubstantial. You can't give yourself meaning living without God. Without God, your job can't give you substance. Without God, your legacy and future generations won't give you significance. Let go of the hope that you're clinging to. Let go of the hope that you're clinging to, that maybe you can find significance, but you don't believe in, or you're not including God in your life. That's the problem the teacher's exposing today. You have this lie that somehow you can find meaning without involving God. Even Christians live like this, and that exposes that they think this as well. I can find meaning without God. So the solution, And we'll wrap this up with this. Solution is to first recognize the truth in what he's saying. It is utterly meaningless to try to find significance without God. The psalmist, I want you to see this, the psalmist comes to this point of realization that occasionally, right, occasionally and sometimes he gets to this point where though he believed in God, he was living without God. And so he says things like this in Psalm chapter 102, verses 3 to 5 and verse 11. The psalmist comes to this point, he realizes I was living without God and my days are vanishing like smoke. My bones burn like glowing embers. My heart is blighted and withered. It withers like grass. I forget to eat my food. In my distress, I groan aloud and I'm reduced to skin and bones. My days are like the evening shadow. I wither away like grass. And he looks at what he's done and he sees I was trying to do it on my own. He has this realization. My day is like a blade of grass that eventually withers. I left God out of it and it was meaningless. And the sooner you admit that without God there's no significance, there's no meaning, when you recognize God is absent in your life, and you recognize that gives me a lack of meaning. When you admit that there's no purpose without including God, and you let go of the absurd notion that you can find significance in life, in this world, in that job, with that house, with those relationships, with those accomplishments, with that future, with the next change, but without God, when you let go of that idea, the sooner you can find meaning and purpose and substance that God offers you. Let go of the idea that you can do it without God. Become disillusioned with your attempts at finding satisfaction without God. Ask yourself, what would it mean to try this with God? What would it mean? How would it look different if I tried to attempt my job with God? If I attempted to spend my money with God? What would it mean if I attempted to live retired with God? What would it mean? How would it look different? Let me give you an example of what it would look like to try this with God. In Psalm chapter 19, and I chose this because verses 4 to 6, because of what the author said. In the heavens, God has pitched a tent for the sun. It is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber. Here I am. I am the sun. Like a champion rejoicing to run his course. Like, all right, here we go. This is the one. This is the race. It rises at one end of the heaven and makes its circuit to the other, and nothing is deprived of its warmth. Do you see the difference in perspective of the sun when you just imagine for a moment that God made it? It is not just this little cycle where it's just hurrying throughout the right, hurry, rises and gets done and rises and gets done over and over and over. No, it is a champion that provides everybody warmth, and it is something to behold. And the only difference is you viewed it with God in mind. And that changes everything. It changes everything about the perspective of the sun, and it gives it purpose. And viewing God, viewing your job in terms of God and including God in it gives it purpose and changes everything. Your relationships, your family, your home, your endeavors, your time, everything. And so consider for a moment, are there areas where you aren't living like you believe in God, where you're only living on your own under the sun? You're trying to make your own. You're trying to do it on your own strength. You're trying to accomplish your own plans. You're not involving God. You don't talk to him about it. You don't bring him up. You don't think about his involvement in what you're doing. Are there parts of your life that you've become wearied and they've begun to feel meaningless? Maybe it's every part of your life. Today, now, you need to acknowledge that without God's involvement, that's why it's meaningless. That's why it's wearisome. And make a commitment, make a decision. I need to involve this. And when you do that, if you do that, like the psalmist discovers, God's finally got something to work with. And you will be on a journey to find actual meaning and significance in everything. Because with God, if we can turn his words on its head, everything has meaning and purpose. Let's pray. God, I know you want to work with us. I know you want to work in us. And so I would just ask that thing that you would bring it to our minds right now, that area of our life where we live without including you, we live as though you don't exist in that area. Bring it to our minds right now. Make us fight that thought and try to push it away because we're uncomfortable with the realization that that is where we live without you. And now, God, give us the courage to grab it and hold it between us and say, God, this is it. This is where I need you to bring meaning in my life. I want you involved. I want you to be a part. I trust you, God. I love you. Help us leave through those doors with a clear realization and idea of where we involve you in our life and the courage to. I pray this in